You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. Retail analysts do not mince words these days. One told the New York Times this week, the reality is there are going to be dark boxes for some time. Those dark boxes are the brick-and-mortar stores, the anchor tenants of shopping malls that have gone out of business or are working through Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. Has the pandemic changed how you shop? Have you been inside your local mall lately? Did you buy anything? What was it like? When was the last time you shopped for clothes in person in a brick-and-mortar store? We're at 800-642-1234. Nancy Wong is department chair and professor in the Consumer Science Department in UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. She's faculty director for the Kohl's Chair in Retail Innovation, where she researches how cultural values influence consumption decisions. Nancy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thanks for having me here.
Well, take us back to March, if you will. The Safer at Home order affected businesses throughout the state as Wisconsinites had to stay home, only going out for essential services like groceries and pharmacy. How did this extended closure affect brick and mortar retail stores?
Well, there's not much surprises there in the sense that everybody had to close down. And I think many retail stores see drastic declined in their sales unless you are in the food and pharmaceutical business. So that change, I think, is probably expected and, you know, as can be anticipated. Although I think the speed at which I think it occurred probably threw quite a lot of people off from that standpoint, but it has definitely changed the retail scene dramatically.
Well, let's look at that drama in the retail scene. Now we've seen stores coming back online, slowly reopening, but very cautiously, lots of precautions inside stores for social distancing and cleanliness. What is that process like? What have you seen as stores reopen their doors?
Well, I guess, you know, there are a lot of things that stores need to have in place to build the confidence of shoppers, I think, shopping there to ensure that their health and security is ensured. And also not to, I think, downplay the concerns for frontline service workers working in these stores. So I think one of the biggest change that I think retailers are faced with, not only dealing with, I think, ensuring the safety of their customers and also in building the confidence of their workers who will be working there, who are working in, again, drastically changed environment.
And how have they made workers more secure? I would imagine that they're putting up some plexiglass, maybe only handling in credit. What are some things that have changed in the shopping experience?
Well, that certainly curtailed a great deal of the shopping experience because the whole premise of the in-store or so-called brand experience is really being able to allow, I think, customers the full spectrum of that experience from touching the merchandise, trying on the merchandise, and displaying the merchandise. And all that has been significantly curtailed. And even though stores are cautiously reopening, I did find that in my most recent visit to a store for picking up essentials that I think the store aisles are fairly empty compared to what I was accustomed to seeing. And also, you know, perhaps the arrangements and the aisles have been widened just to ensure that I think customers can socially distance in an environment to build that kind of, and, you know, noticing that the checkout lines are sort of like, again, well, sort of mark to ensure that customers can stay a safe distance and all that. So all of that has drastically changed the retail environment. And unfortunately, that also reduced, I think, whatever pleasure and enjoyment out of that shopping experience that most customers were accustomed to, I think, going to the stores for is for that experience.
Right. Shopping used to be fun. Now it's very stressful and you're only getting what you absolutely need. It's completely turned shopping on its head.
Yes.
We're talking with Nancy Wong, explaining the retail space during the pandemic. Nancy is a professor in the Consumer Science Department in UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. What about you? Have you been to a mall recently? Did you buy anything? What was the experience like? What brick-and-mortar stores do you still go into, and what are you purchasing? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Nancy, a lot of brick-and-mortar businesses turn to curbside pickup for merchandise. How has curbside been taken by the consumer?
Well, I think to varying degrees. I guess most of us have probably experienced curbside pickup and that kind of experience for food shopping and food delivery and groceries picked up and delivery. So, or maybe pharmaceuticals. So I think most of us have actually utilized that those services during the shelter-in-place period, and for good reasons, because those are usually the only services that are available to us from the retailers and what is actually allowed, I think, during that period. So I think there are a few consequences or outcomes based on that experience, in the sense that some customers are probably experiencing this for the first time and realize that this is actually a great way to shop. if you're not the browsing kind. And so I think that actually has enhanced maybe in some ways the shopping experience, that there is this whole other way of shopping that people may not have realized before. However, that also, I think, completely cut down on the possibilities of us finding surprises in the checkout aisles, impulse purchases, and, you know, because we no longer had the opportunity to browse through the shopping aisles and discovering things, you know, which is actually, as you said, part of the fun of shopping.
Right. I mean, I thought I had such an aha moment when Barnes & Noble popped the books and the kids' toys in the trunk. But then it was like, is that it? That's it. You know, and you just drive away. And you're right. The discovery of browsing is gone.
Yes.
Do you think that will come back? How optimistic are you about people feeling comfortable shopping in person over the next few months?
I think it really varies across individuals. Some people who love to shop, and I remember reading an article about a woman who is a self-proclaimed shopaholic. You know, she couldn't, I think this was, I think, perhaps in Houston, she couldn't wait for the stores to reopen. And the minute they reopened, she was like one of the first customers and she was happily shopping. So I think some people are completely undeterred by that. And, you know, they take the precautions of wearing the mask and keeping social distance. I do believe that I think people can actually do shopping fairly safely. I think the perception perhaps comes from the shoppers in terms of how comfortable they feel about going into the store environment. And I think the mall environment, which has been, I think, drastically changed. And I think the level of activities and enjoyment that people get from going to the malls could also vary depending on where you go.
Well, I the mall is just going through a lot of turmoil right now, and I really want to dig into that with you. We're looking at how retail is faring during the pandemic as shopping shifts to the digital environment. What does that mean for our malls and big box stores? Nancy Wong is a professor in the Consumer Science Department, UW-Madison. Are you shopping online exclusively or just some of the time? What's behind that decision? Have you been taking extra precautions during your trips to the store or when unpacking your purchases at home? Tell us about how you're shopping, where you're going, and what you're doing at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a minute with Nancy Wong here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the retail revolution or the impending retail apocalypse, as the headlines dramatically describe the surge in department stores and mom-and-pop retailers that are going out of business. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're looking at the changing retail landscape in our Wisconsin communities and what the future holds for our local malls, our strip malls, our freestanding stores. Familiar names like JCPenney, Sears, J.Crew all filed for bankruptcy. Is your indoor mall a ghost town? Have the stores you shopped at in the past closed down, or are they hanging on? Where do you go now? Or have you transitioned to all online shopping? Be part of this 800-642-1234. We have UW-Madison consumer psychologist Nancy Wong, who is our guide. So, Nancy, small businesses often have, you know, special relationships with their customers. They know their customers sometimes by name. How are small businesses in our communities doing during this pandemic?
I'm not too familiar with many of the small retailers, but yes, I think it is not a surprising thing that they are clearly struggling right now. And because many of the key drivers of their business, as you know, so rightly say, are built on personal relationships. And it is very difficult to sustain that kind of in-person service, you know, in the middle of the shutdown. So despite the fact that they may have very loyal customers, that could also be key to their ability to be able to come back as soon as I think they are able to reopen safely. So I think that could well be a reflection of the kind of connections that they are able to build with their local customers, because again, we are not going anywhere. So I think to the extent that they are able to stay afloat during that time, it's during this time would be the critical factor.
I want to look at online shopping here for a moment. I've been keeping an eye on Kohl's CEO, Michelle Goss, and she said recently that digital is roughly 25% of Kohl's business. Not enough, she said, to offset losses. What are you seeing out of Kohl's right now?
Well, I cannot speak for what Kohl's plans to do in the future, but then I think they are actually uniquely positioned to be able to actually, in some ways, take advantage of the current situation. Especially, I think one of the things that I think happens in a pandemic or a crisis such as this is it could well be opportunities for others to get ahead if they are making the right investments and if they are well positioned to do so. Because, you know, as you have mentioned earlier, given the demise of other competitors, some of them are going to emerge out of it stronger than before. So and I think certain players are well positioned to be able to move into that space, because I think the customers are still going to be there. And it's also an opportunity for, I think, retailers to think about where Amazon is weak, because, you know, even though they seem to be the biggest players right now, the Walmarts and the Amazons, but then it also reveals places where they are weak. And I think there are some real opportunities here as well, despite the gloom.
Yeah, you know, Kohl's is largely freestanding stores. You don't have to walk through a mall to get to a Kohl's store. Is that an advantage in terms of how they're positioned?
Yes, I think so. And very much so, that because I think even the scenery that you have just described about the doom and gloom in many black spaces, which are probably going to continue regardless. I think what this pandemic has done is perhaps accelerated, I think, the speed at which that this is happening. And I think it is inevitable that it will happen. But I think the shopping scene is going to emerge as almost a tale of two cities. I think you're going to see certain kind of malls that are built and or the concepts, I think, lend itself to actually come out stronger when this is over. And certain malls are just going to be converted into something else and being spaces that are being reimagined and reutilized into a different version of itself.
we're checking in on the plight of retailers and brick-and-mortar stores, the malls in our community amid the economic downturn. Nancy Wong is a professor in the Consumer Science Department in UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. You can join in. How are you shopping? Have you moved completely online? Did you start shopping online more recently? How comfortable are you buying clothes you can't try on or other accessories? Do you trust websites with your card information and your personal information? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Nancy, how does that work? When you as a customer, you shop online, you can't try on the clothes, you can't try on those items. Does that translate into purchases still when customers can't feel what they're buying?
It still does converge into purchases. There is no question about it, because I think right after the pandemic, I mean, right during it right now, I guess, what retailers have seen is we have big basket sizes in the sense that, and what they call high conversion rates, because people were just buying things and stockpiling and perhaps, you know, mostly the necessities that they need, and they try to make fewer trips and maybe fewer purchases to sort of like combine all their purchases into one online order or one shopping trip. So I think that is still happening, but then and you know, the downside of it, maybe there would be more returns as well, or fewer returns, because people just decided that, you know, it is not worth the hassle of going back to the returns. And but you know, I think what has changed is perhaps what purchases people are making, as opposed to, I think, what they are shopping for.
What kind of purchases are they making?
Well, you know, the infamous toilet papers, face masks, sanitizers, you know, people are stockpiling on this, and maybe food essentials and various other things. People are baking more and food for sure, and pharmaceutical products, and well, also, I guess alcoholic beverages have gone up, too.
Well, John emailed us this morning, and John hopes shoppers learn from the pandemic that they don't need all of the stuff they're addicted to buying. John says people should buy what they need, not what they want. Nancy, could the pandemic shift long-term attitudes?
I think yes and no. First of all, I think attitudes are, well, people don't really change that easily. And, you know, a lot of our habits and how we are used to consuming has been with us for a long time. And I guess perhaps it comes down to how long is this change in shopping behavior going to last. So we have gone through it for about 3 months. And I think if we can actually feel comfortable and safely go back to stores, and perhaps a lot of the old habits are going to come back. However, I think if we remain, I think, sort of online for, you know, a good more months, I think, through this, then perhaps people are really going to change. But I think many of us do realize as we go through this, I think, experiences that, yes, there are a lot of things that we don't really need. We certainly need, to be perfectly honest, I haven't put on cosmetics for a long time, and I realized that I really don't need any of them because you don't have to go out anymore.
Feeling so beautiful in your own skin at home.
That's right. So, yes, I think it is certainly making us realize that there are so many things that we don't need, but it also could be an outcome of the fact that we are living very different lives right now because we don't go out as much. We don't have to, you know, put on different outfits every day, but then, you know, loungewears and, you know, some other essentials have actually gone through the roof because we are wearing more of those.
I heard shorts, the sales of shorts are going through the roof.
Absolutely.
You know, where do those shopping habits form? You say that it takes a long time to change a consumer because they have these ingrained habits. How do they get formed in the first place?
Well, it can come from so many different ways. But, you know, it's usually our way of life, the way we were socialized as kids. You know, those of us could remember going to with our mothers to the shopping mall during Black Friday, for that matter, right? And so we have, you know, many of us have, I think, fond memories of going to the malls, perhaps. this is where, you know, we used to hang out with friends, you know, at the food court and trying out different merchandise. And to many teenagers, that was like perhaps a rite of passage to go to the mall, you know, on a weekend.
So yeah, where have all the mall rats gone? Mall rats of our generation.
They go online.
Yeah, they go online. But, you know, I think, and it's interesting you say we look to the people in our life, like our mothers and how they shopped, which may explain some of our shopping habits today.
Definitely. And sometimes, I guess, you know, I remember doing this research projects with my students about Thanksgiving. And, you know, I tell them to write an ethnography of, you know, how they spend their Thanksgiving. And I would say maybe 80, 90% of the students talk about going to the mall on Black Friday. That has been part of the family ritual for like generations. They don't necessarily need to buy anything. Just, you know, being there, getting into the holiday spirit has been part of that experience.
Nancy Wong is faculty director for the Kohl's Chair in Retail Innovation at UW-Madison, where she researches how cultural values influence consumption decisions. Do you think your mall will stay open? Have the anchor tenants gone out of business? What is in their place? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with Nancy Wong after a news update on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A report from UBS predicts that 100,000 brick-and-mortar retail stores in our country will close over the next 5 years. It's a trend that started before COVID-19 and one that was accelerated by stay-at-home orders and pandemic shutdowns. So are you shopping online more? How comfortable are you buying clothing and accessories, other items online? Do you work at a mall? What has it been like since reopening? Has anything replaced the Shopko or the Toys R Us buildings that went dark after they went out of business? Share what retail looks like, feels like in your community at 800-642-1234. We have consumer psychologist Nancy Wong as our guide. She's faculty director for the Kohl's Chair in Retail Innovation at UW-Madison. Nancy, I want to look at diversity and inclusion and how retailers are responding to racism in their communities and where they do business. Kohl's CEO announced the creation of a task force and unconscious bias training rolling out across Kohl's. They also launched internal focus group sessions. What should retailers be thinking like as they see the protests around the company and how they respond as a business?
Well, we are definitely living in very turbulent times. And I think all those actions and our programs are very much welcome and encouraged. But I think there are many things that, again, I guess, as a cultural psychologist, many of our so-called implicit bias that it's extremely difficult to overcome. And it is something that really takes conscious efforts on the individuals to be constantly aware of it, because I think most of our actions is actually so deeply embedded in our socialization, I think, in our entire life, that a single training session is not likely to actually deliver the kind of outcomes that we might be hoping for. So again, you know, this is going back to similar things as habits and socializations, that it's something that takes, I think, very concerted effort and a continuous kind of work in progress, I would say. It is encouraging that we are moving in that direction, but it is still not an easy thing to accomplish.
I wonder if companies could set benchmarks and expand in their buying in terms of buying more from minority-owned businesses, buying from designers who are small upstarts. Would that start making a change?
That is definitely a step in the right direction, because those are very visible actions and very visible display of efforts towards in that direction. And I think that is definitely muchly encouraged. And I think we on our part have tried really hard to recruit students from different diverse backgrounds into the retail profession simply because there is a real lack of, I think, professionals working in these businesses as well. So I guess a lot of effort needs to start sort of upstream. You need to hire people who are receptive to these ideas or who are familiar with how these clients are going to actually respond to these merchandise, who come with a deep understanding because they are one of the members from that community. So I think we try hard to do our part at the university to recruit students from those backgrounds as well.
Oh, it infiltrates every department from marketing to the customer experience in store to what you actually sell there.
Right. You start with the people first.
Yeah. Let's take a call now. Ben is with us from West Salem. Good morning, Ben.
Morning. I heard this right. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, how has your shopping experience changed?
It hasn't changed too much. I care much for the environment, and when the shopping kick to buy things on Amazon kicked off right away, I already saw that people were returning things many times. But I would say, and that concerns me, the back and forth of the larger trucks. But I'm a disabled person that has to travel from a small town of about 5,000, maybe less, to a larger town to get my clothing. And due to my disabilities, I have had to return things multiple times online. And it makes a pair of pants purchase turn into sometimes a 5 or a 6 week endeavor just to get a pair of pants. So brick and mortar stores are in some respects are very necessary to people, I believe, just because the timing it takes to return an article of clothing and then get another, because not a lot of people can say, oh, this doesn't fit, so I'll buy another $80-$90 set of pants, or if you need to buy something special, or even a $35 pair of Levi's or Carhartt pants, you know?
They got to fit right.
Yeah, they got to fit right. You're going to wear them for the next, let's just be honest, you know, stuff like that, it lasts for 5 years. You're not gonna buy, you know, something that's not going to fit right, unless you have to. But, so I would just say that, you know, the stores are necessary. They're very necessary. It goes along with a greener environment and helping our world out in our local community as well.
Well, Ben, thank you so much for sharing that perspective. And Nancy, Ben brings up a number of issues here. And one of the issues is those returns. When you think about the packaging and the emissions of those trucks, you know, taking the package back to that store and then getting another size or another shipment, there is a lot of back and forth here.
Oh, absolutely. I'm completely with Ben on this, which is why I think I hate shopping online for, I think, apparel, especially things that are difficult to fit. And I think that is perhaps the one final barrier that I think online shopping has strived hard to, I think, overcome. But I don't think it's going to be all that successful because there are certain kind of purchases that are just not the same, I think, without that tactile feel and that physical interaction with the merchandise. So that's the kind of shopping that I don't think it's ever going to go away. However, you know, most of us are comfortable with buying not so much groceries, perhaps, but, you know, the plain things, you know, we don't think twice about buying socks online or t-shirts could be challenging. Stationery perhaps, and other things that are very standardized that doesn't require fitting. So those kind of purchases can easily go online.
And Ben seems to wear things for the long haul, buys, the quality in one purchase and then wears that for years to come. And there's a term that escapes me, Nancy, right now, but, you know, where you buy things and they just become completely disposable after a few uses. But have we turned away from that in clothing?
I think so. I think what this particular crisis has shown us is that there are so many things that we don't need in our daily life, and things are definitely moving from that direction. I think the term they are looking for is like fast fashion.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yes. And I think, as the name suggests, I think they are designed to go out of style, and they are designed to almost break down after a very short use. And I think what this, I think, event has shown us is that I think we are moving away from that. And I like to think that, you know, we are moving towards, I think, buying products that are better made, better sourced, that is, I think, in a sustainable way, and that we use them for a long time. And then, you know, when you know, we are done with it, we can recycle them, repurpose them for other use. And I think that may well coincide with the rise of, what do you call it? You shop vintage, you shop, you know, used products. So I think I see that market emerging as well, too. So I think those are all steps in the right direction.
Or even those old T-shirts turning into cleaning rags. Nancy Wong is with us, a professor in the Consumer Science Department in UW-Madison School of Human Ecology, and she's our guide with how retail is affected by the turbulent economic times due to the pandemic and shifting consumer trends that we're seeing toward online. What are your purchases like? Join in 800-642-1234. Nancy, what is it like with your students right now? What are you telling them as they enter this environment and want to work in this world of retail?
Well, I think what we need to focus on are the fundamentals of how people shop. I think it is people are still going to buy things. They are going to buy perhaps different things. So I think what we emphasize is to help our students think through that process and understand that, in a sense that, you know, we might call it retail, we might call it e-commerce. I mean, that those labels come and go, but I guess it doesn't change that fundamental process whereby we still need to bring goods to the customers, and the consumers are still going to need to buy things. And how do you actually choose to deliver on that promise in different ways to fulfill that kind of consumer needs? I think there is always going to be a need out there. So, you know, you need to offer them perhaps different things in light of changing values and habits and all that. And you need to deliver that to them in different forms. And yes, that is a challenge. But I think we have always gone through challenges and changes like that. So I don't see that going away. So I think the emphasis is to actually going back to the basics and understanding how do we actually change the way we deliver that services to the customers.
Nancy Wong, professor in the Consumer Science Department, UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. Still time to talk about your shopping experience, how it's changed during the pandemic, and what strip malls, brick and mortar stores look like in your town. Are they open? Are cars in parking lots? Will they survive this? We're at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Nancy Wong here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The retail sector lost about 1.2 million jobs between March and June, and analysts say many COVID-19 store closures that were supposed to be temporary will wind up permanently going dark. The likes of Victoria's Secret, Bath & Body Works, The Gap all said they'll reduce their footprint. We're with Professor Nancy Wong, a consumer analyst at UW-Madison. Let's take a call now. Joe is joining us from Neenah. Hi, Joe.
Hello. I probably have done more attention to online buying, but I feel sorry for brick-and-mortar stores because they can't carry all the inventory. And a lot of times we go over there to check something out, to see what its quality, and then we buy online because it may have a cheaper price. What I think there should be is a partnership between the retailer and the brick-and-mortar store so that when you check out something at a brick-and-mortar store, they get some credit, they get a percentage of the sale, or something is worked out between the two, because we just can't buy things without seeing it and then return it. That's the big problem with this whole thing.
Joe, thanks. Nancy, what do you make of that arrangement?
Joe, thanks for your input. And I think that is absolutely true. But then I think perhaps most of the major retailers like Kohl's and others all have what we call these omni-channel approach, in the sense that they have gone a long way in integrating the online and the offline environment, that, you know, they treat it as one single purchase from one single customer. And I guess, so I think if you're shopping from the same retailer, it really doesn't matter whether you're shopping it for your merchandise online or offline. And in fact, if you go to a physical stores in Kohl's, if they don't have the sizes that you need or whatever, or the color that you want, you can just actually place an order for it to be delivered to your home that is the right size and the right color. So if you're shopping within the same retail channel or network, it really doesn't matter, because I think what neat stores have already moved towards is to integrate all their retail channels. I think the other problem that we might face is we go what we call showrooming, which is for customers to go and check out the physical merchandise in the stores and then go back and order from Amazon because the prices are cheaper. And I think that is not going to be a sustainable, I think, environment. And so there need to be, I think, greater collaboration and integration going forward between the offline and the online retailers.
Let's bring in Maheen now in Madison. Hi, Maheen.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure.
I was just going to add that, you know, as a consumer, one image that has stuck with me through this pandemic was this. It was a view of the world specifically focused on China, you know, pre-COVID, and then when their economy kind of shut down, and how the earth looked so much cleaner as a result. And I think the pandemic has brought to light the human habits and their effect on the planet, and whether those habits were retail habits or, you know, habits with traveling to and from work every day. And I think moving forward, people want to decide what the new normal is going to be that is a little bit more sustainable and impactful in a positive way. You know, how many jobs can be done from home? How much traveling is necessary? Not only what are essential workers, but what is essential for us in our homes? And definitely consumerism has played a role in the planet's destruction. And I think any retail that wants to emerge out of this kind of needs to have that in mind, sustainability.
Maheen, thank you so much for bringing that. And Nancy, in just a few moments left, what would you say there?
Thank you so much for your input, Maheen. That is really insightful. And that, I think, is, you know, it's very hopeful. And I think it is a wake-up call for us to rethink how we consume and how we live our lives, and bringing home the fact that whatever our old habits have been is clearly not sustainable, and we need to rethink how we want to move forward and what that new normal is. And I think hopefully for a large majority of us, that would be the case, because I think maybe there's nothing like a pandemic to shake up old habits and make us question our habits. Although, you know, the other side of me would also say that it is incredibly hard to change. And the reason that habits form is because it's the easiest or the path of least resistance, something that we are so used to doing. So it takes a huge amount of effort. And sometimes, sadly, for certain people, there are no other options.
Well, Nancy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Nancy Wong, consumer psychologist, exploring cultural values influencing consumption decisions. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a writer's own food tradition.
Food can conjure up vivid memories of childhood. The tastes and smells can send us to another place while creating new memories in the moment. That's why writer Nancy Jorgensen has been thinking a lot about her German heritage and being raised on raw foods.
My cousins and I spit the last of our watermelon seeds into Nana's lawn and tumbled into the house. I was 10 years old, or maybe 6 or 12. In the kitchen, Nana leaned against the counter. She stroked my cheek with one hand and held a plate in the other, slaughtered beef, freshly ground and bloody red. Our parents circled an oak table. My uncles clutched Gettleman or Old Milwaukee and blew cigarette smoke. On the stove, pickles boiled in vinegar. The smoke and steam made my breath catch. Mother got up from the table, and in a few seconds, a knife rested in her hand. In front of her, a loaf of rye. On the counter, a shaker of salt. "Would you like some raw beef and onions?" I put out my hand. I was raised on this traditional German food, along with kraut from Nana's stoneware crock, and sausage from her hand-cranked meat grinder, oozed into animal intestine casings. We rarely ate in restaurants, our parents and grandparents creating meals from hand-tilled gardens, ancient grapevines, or a neighbor's Holstein. Now, my family often eats in restaurants. Last month, my husband Joel and I spent a week in Portland with our adult daughter, Gwen. One night in a local pub, she considered appetizers. On the menu, steak tartare. With a new name and extra ingredients, uncooked egg and capers, it was still Nana's raw beef and onions. We cook at home, too, and last week, our older daughter Elizabeth prepared dinner for us. While we sipped Shiraz, she presented a tenderloin, crisp on the edges, but red and bleeding from the middle, just a few degrees past rare. Each bite, dipped in horseradish, stung my nose with a prickly ache. It took me back to Nana's garden, where that gnarly root grew among her beets and kohlrabi and turnips. I savored the burn. As Nana peeled carrots or cooked a warm potato salad dressing, she told me I was German and Pennsylvania Dutch. Her pride, like her red-checked tablecloth, underpinned every meal. It was clear my daughters inherited her German pedigree and taste for hearty dishes. A while back, Gwen, Elizabeth, Joel, and I spent 5 minutes spitting into tubes. When the results came back, Nana's genetics weren't as strong as I believed. My German DNA is less than 33%. I'm also 11% Scandinavian and 13% British. And Nana never mentioned over pork chops that I'm 8% Ashkenazi Jewish. I wonder what those ancestors would say about our habits with uncooked meat and milk from the neighbor's cow. Before the holidays this year, we planned our Christmas menu. Gwen chose pickled herring, popular with German fishermen. Elizabeth requested pretzels, a German baking tradition. And I made German apple pie. But then I whipped a pint of cream, a British birthright, and dropped meatballs in gravy, definitely Danish. We included a Mediterranean salad, Asian egg rolls, and southern pecan pie. Surveying the dishes, I realized our German heritage a muted presence. But our Wisconsin ties shouted. Piper porch wine, raised grain beer, Wisconsin-produced milk. From our own garden, pickled cucumbers, heirloom tomatoes, Duchess apples. A bounty of food and tradition, as wide as the world and as narrow as Wisconsin.
Nancy Jorgensen is a writer based in Waukesha. And her story is part of a project from Wisconsin Life called Food Traditions. It's a multimedia exploration of food, culture, and identity, and can be found at wisconsinlife.org/foodtraditions. And we want to hear about your own food traditions. Share them with us on Instagram. Just search for Wisconsin Life. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.